It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
Singer-songwriter John McLaughlin is bringing heart, soul, and storytelling to Las Vegas via his Scenarios tour, taking the stage at Myron's at the Smith Center on April the 11th. From his breakout debut, Indiana, to his current album, Scenarios, or Scenarios, depending on what part of the country you're from, John has built a career on deeply personal, piano-driven songs that connect in powerful ways. Today, we're talking about his musical journey, his evolution as an artist, and the stories behind the songs that resonate with fans everywhere. For ticket information, go to thesmithcenter.com, thesmithcenter.com. For everything about John, go to johnmcl.com, johnmcl.com. Follow him on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And John, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So what is it about you and pianos? Can you explain that to us here?
Great leadoff question.
As opposed to a xylophone or a kazoo, or what is it about a piano?
We didn't have a xylophone in my house when I was growing up. I guess Fair we enough. Just had a piano. I'm the youngest of three, and my brother, my sister, they were all taking piano lessons like, as long as I can remember. So I don't have any memories where I wasn't already playing piano, you know. And if it was a xylophone, I'd probably be playing xylophone, you know.
Now, your dad was a musician, right? And I think your grandfather was a musician as well.
That's right. Yeah.
Did they play the xylophone or also piano?
They probably played some xylophone throughout the years, but they were both woodwind guys. My granddad played clarinet, a little bit of saxophone, but clarinet was his main thing. And my dad grew up playing saxophone, played bass as well. He was, mainly remember him playing bass when I was younger. He was playing with a band. That's actually how he met my mom. He was on tour with his band. He dropped out of college and went on tour and met my mom she was a bartender at a show down in Texas. My dad's from Indiana. So, you know, music is just in the blood on that side.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I know you got two daughters and they're going to eventually probably inherit your passion. You don't want to force it on them, but there is a piano in the house from what I understand. So want to noodle the keys a little bit, they could do it. So,
they do for sure. They do. And you're right. I haven't forced it on them. This is an issue that I don't know if I'm doing it right or not, because it's not what I grew up with. I grew up in lessons every week. It was very regimented, and that's not what they have, because I saw it as a small miracle that I stuck with music. Most of the time I wanted to quit and play basketball, and my parents, you know, saw that I was better at piano than I am at basketball, so they kept me in it. But my daughter, there's a piano in the house, there's a piano back here in my studio, and whatever they want to learn, I kind of show them, I teach them, and they mess around with it, and they're definitely drawn to it. They love music. They're great singers, and they have a knack for piano.
Yeah, they're going to have a great head start in that household, I think.
Yeah, hopefully.
You mentioned your dad not going to college, but you did, and there's a gentleman there, a professor, that actually got you really hooked on music, despite your musical background at home. Jonathan Brooks. So tell us a little bit about Jonathan Brooks.
That's right. Hey, kudos to your research here. I'm impressed. Yes, Dr. Brooks, I believe my freshman year was his first year teaching. I believe I have that right, because at the time it was just Professor Brooks. It wasn't even Dr. Brooks yet. But I took his theory, you know, 101. I'd never taken a theory class. I took oral comprehension with him. And you know, the program at Anderson University was very classical based. And so we were doing like Roman numeral analysis of these Bach, you know, fugues and stuff like that, which I saw as being completely pointless. All I wanted to do was just write music. in the practice rooms. But for the first time, I realized how simple music was, you know, how like you just have 12 notes. That's all there is. There's just 12 notes. And most songs are, you know, 1, 4, 5, you know, it's where that saying three chords and the truth come from. And all these, you know, these like Beethoven pieces and stuff like that. It was a lot of like, oh, this is really 1, 4, 5. It's just now he modulates to another key. And that's way you feel like there are a million different chords, but it's really just 1, 4, 5. He's just going. Anyway, Dr. Brooks completely opened this whole side of music that really changed things for me. Dr. Brooks and then Dr. Freeling was my piano professor. Those two were huge in my musical, you know, journey.
Have they followed your career?
Yeah, I kept in touch with Dr. Freeling. In fact, I think it was earlier this year, he lives down in Florida now, and I was playing. He came to the show, so I got to see him. And I wasn't as close with Dr. Brooks because I just took those two classes with him. And, you know, he had no idea if I was even enjoying his classes. The only reason why I know that is because years later, I went back to Anderson University. And I was part of this, you know, this weekend event where I was doing a Q&A, and the dean of the music department was asking me some questions. And he said, do you have any advice for any of the young, you know, music students here at Anderson University now? And I said, if Dr. Brooks is still here, take any class he's teaching. Just take every class he's
Great
teaching.
Advice.
Yeah. And I got to say, because he was huge, you know, everything I just told you. So afterward, he found me. I didn't even know if he was still a professor there. He found me. I hadn't seen him in, you know, at that point, 15, 17 years or something like that. And he said, I had no idea. I thought you hated my class.
He remembered you.
He remembered. Yeah. And he was, which I'm like, yeah, I can see that. Cause I never participated. I didn't really want to be there in the beginning. You know, it took a while for me to even realize the significance of what he was teaching, you know? And of course, you know, as just a self-absorbed, you know, 20-year-old, I had no wherewithal to be like, maybe I should go and thank him for what he's done for me. So I was so grateful that I had that night back in my alma mater that I could say that. And I'm so grateful that he was there and that we got to connect in that way.
Closing the circle, it's a great moment in anybody's life when you can do that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you decided to go pro, and I don't mean football, although you would have liked to, or basketball, actually. But
basketball,
when you decided to go pro, your approach and style and thought process is very personal. Your songs reflect that. Why did you decide to go that particular road versus so many other ways you could go in terms of song?
Yeah.
Music.
You know, I think there may be two main elements there. One is writing lyrics in sort of the hierarchy of compliments that one could give. You know, someone could come up to you and say, I love your show. And they could say a couple different things. And maybe for you, you may personally be like, I want them to say, you ask questions that I never would have thought. You're such a great question asker or whatever. You know, but there's probably a hierarchy for you as an interviewer mm-hmm. that you would prefer. And it's same for me. If someone comes up to me and says, you're a great singer, I'm of course grateful. Any compliment is great. You know, thank you. But that's not high on my list. And if I had to say my number one, it's probably a lyricist. And then like in a quick almost tie for first is a pianist. And so lyrics just matter to me. And there are times that I wish that they didn't, because there are bands that I listen to and artists that I listen to where the lyrics seemingly are so throwaway. Half the time I'm like, I don't even know what they're saying. I just love this song. And it's like the lyric is not a part so much You know, it's not like with Bob Dylan, it's like, well, it's about the lyric. You know, with Dawes, it's about the lyric. You know, with other artists, it's not so. And I've had times where I've been jealous of that. And I've thought, maybe I'll just be one of those guys where I'm like, it's not about the lyric. I'm just singing whatever. It's about the song. But that, at the end of the day, I'm like, as much as I would like for that to be true, because it would make for less work for me, it just doesn't, for whatever reason, it just doesn't fit. And so the lyric has to matter. And for it to matter, it has to be personal, you know? And the other reason is I grew up in the church as a believer, and I knew that I didn't want to go into Christian music. I didn't want to be a Christian artist. I just never wanted to. And I felt like as soon as you do that, you limit yourself to those who would be willing to go into that section of the record store, to use an outdated reference.
I love it though.
Yeah. To even look at those records, you know?
Yeah. So I was looking at the record bins on Amazon.com the other day.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought, if you're going to do that, which is a true thing, I think my reasons for doing that were always felt true and pure. Then I'm like, well, then you got to be honest. Your responsibility as a songwriter is then to just write songs as honestly as possible and see what comes out.
And you obviously connect with people. When you were mentioning about the emphasis on lyrics for you, I was thinking you're the Ira Gershwin rather than the George Gershwin.
Mm. Yeah. It's funny that you say that, because I'm obsessed with Gershwin right now.
Oh, they're wonderful, both of them. But Ira did the lyrics, George did the melodies. They're both together. It's wonderful. But I think your focus on lyrics can emphasize your personal a point of view more than the music, the melody side of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, if someone were to come up and be like, "Gosh, you're just like Ira and George Gershwin in one," I would cry.
Yeah,
like, that's the ultimate compliment.
Exactly right. Yeah. That may happen yet. Wait for it.
Yeah, we'll
see. Especially when you come to the Smith Center, April 11th at Myron's.
That's right.
Is it your first time performing in Las Vegas?
It is, which I can't believe that.
Yeah,
Years and years ago, I did have a show scheduled there. I don't remember. This is a terrible story because I don't even remember why I had to cancel it. But I mean, it was never, we never actually publicized it. We never got that. But we had like a hold at a venue and I wanted to play there. And for whatever reason, I had to cancel it. But yeah, I've been to Vegas many times for private events and things like that. But I've never played an actual show there. So
you'll enjoy it, especially that room. It's very good for sound.
Yeah.
Lights modeled it recently too, so it's even better. When you, I can't keep getting over the fact, I'm thinking to myself, you look so clean cut, and yet, you know, it's and you're not a Christian performer, as you say, a Christian music performer, but and your music is personal, your lyrics obviously are personal, and yet you just look so, maybe it's the Indiana in you look so wholesome and clean cut.
It's true. If the camera could come down, you could see I do have lots of tattoos.
Yes.
But even the tattoos are wholesome. You know,
yes,
I've got like
tattoos.
Bible verses and my kids' names and things like that. Yeah. You know, it's funny when my wife and I were newly married and we moved into a neighborhood in Indianapolis where we're both from. And we were meeting one of the new neighbors. And at the time I had a couple tattoos and I had a motorcycle. And this woman, just in passing in the conversation, was like, yeah, that restaurant over there, it's great. It used to be awful. It was filled with, you know, it was kind of a biker bar, just, you know, guys with tattoos and motorcycles. And I'm like, I look so clean cut that she's like, surely this is safe for me to say this in front of you.
You immediately rolled up your sleeves at that point and she had a heart attack.
Right. And she's like, no, that one doesn't count.
That to me would be a great story to incorporate in a song. I just think that's a very
that is true
concept. Well, I hate to almost ask this because it's so formulaic as a question, but I do get intrigued by artists that I talk with who are writers and composers and do both the Ira and George Gershwin of it all. But do you have a process? And maybe that's not the right word. Procedure, approach that you take to writing music. In other words, I ask authors a lot of times about this. Do they sit down one day, 1 hour a day, or for a block of time, or just when the inspiration hits, or is it every other Tuesday, or after breakfast, mm-hmm. or before breakfast, something along those lines?
Yeah. I mean, the answer is yes. I think for any creator, I think maybe the number one important thing to keep in mind or to discover is what inspires you. And if I go on, you know, I like to run, and if I go on a run and I force myself to listen to music, and particularly music that I don't know, if I force myself to listen to new music, I will have an idea. I will get inspired on some level. And then, you know, it's just a matter of sitting down at the piano and just being there. It's almost like a numbers game. It's like, just be at the piano, just mess around, come up with something. And so that's kind of my way into the room. You know, I told a friend of mine when he was, you know, he has a kind of more conventional job, and I was talking about how hard writing is, you know, and he's like, but of course it seems not hard. I mean, what's hard about it? Like, you obviously can write songs, so you can do it. What's so hard about it for you? And I said, imagine, like, you know where your office is. So every day you get up and you just go to your office. Imagine if every day you don't know where your office is. You get up and you shower and you have your breakfast and you get in your car and you start driving. You're like, we're starting from scratch every day. And then at the end of the day, you come home and your wife's like, how was your day? And you're like, I couldn't find it today. I have no idea where it is. That's what it feels like as a writer. But those two things, you know, getting inspired, going to see other concerts, and just sitting at the piano. That's my best. Those are my best chances. Those gives me my best chances of finding the office.
How do you react when you, because you're so busy with the family as well and touring, but when you do sit down at your office where sometimes you can find it, mm-hmm. as you're driving around after breakfast, but yeah. Do you work it out where it's somewhat schizophrenic in the sense that because you're working from home, the family has to understand there's a period of time when you're working at the piano and you're coming up with a song to leave you alone and not come in to tie shoelaces or time for dinner or whatever happens to be?
Yeah. You know, I mean, really, my daughters are 13 and 10, almost 11 now.
Well, the shoelaces, don't worry. Yeah, that doesn't matter anymore. So.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean... you know, 8 years ago, I was in the thick of it. Now it's like, I've got so much time. There's no excuse now. You know, I mean, my girls are so busy. There's some days where, like, you know, I drop them off at school and I don't see them for like 10 hours, you know, so
plenty of time.
So I've got lots of time. Yeah. And I've got my own little space that's not attached to the house. That's crucial.
Yeah.
My wife, if she were here, she would be like, we only function that way. It's got to be, he's got to have his own space that's not attached to the house.
Yeah, that's a definite understanding. And it's also a lot more peaceful in the house when you're
for sure, yeah,
next door in that sense. When did you get a sense that you had succeeded, not where totally where you want to succeed, but that you were starting to make inroads, that you hit not a plateau, I'm trying to think of the word. How did you know you hit a certain point where you go, you know what, this is my path. It's working. And obviously I've gotten external validation for it. So I'm clearly doing something right. And I'm going to continue to do that. Churning out, word isn't churning, but creating new albums, writing new material, performing and touring. Was there a point along the way that the light went on for you in that sense?
Yes. I mean, it's a little bit of a complicated answer. Because truthfully, I feel like, I mean, for one, I just always wanted to do it. So there was no decision in that regard. It was just like, well, this is definitely what I'm going to do with my life, or I'm going to try. And then, you know, I had the naivete of youth where I'm just like, there's no chance that it wouldn't work out. What do you mean? You know, like, you know, but I do remember there was one, this was probably 20 years ago. It was my band and I, and Amy, my wife, she was with us all the time. And we were driving around in our van and trailer that was about to fall apart at any moment. I was literally held together with like a couple rolls of duct tape, this trailer. And our tour manager was always sat in the very back. He was always making calls to venues and stuff like that. And we were on our way to Denver, you know, driving like 2 days to get to Denver. And I remember him saying like, "Hey, good news, the Denver show sold out." And I do remember that moment. That was the first time I'd ever had a sold out show. And it was in Denver. I mean, like, you know, it'd be one thing if it were in Indiana, but it was in Denver. And I thought, oh, wow. Okay. People are really coming out. I mean, because the first, you know, when I graduated from college, I just hit the road and like, you know, went on tour with zero regard for marketing or, you know, I was just excited to go play in Memphis at the High Tone Cafe. And then when no one came, I mean, technically one guy came and it was only because he thought I was John McLaughlin of the Mahavishnu Orchestra. And he stayed for a couple songs and then left. But I was just, I was just so young and naive. I didn't even think of like, I guess at that point, success was just being at the High Tone Cafe. Like that's a real venue. You know, like I had no regard for like, well, how do you sustain this financially? You know, there was none of that. But I do remember that moment with Denver and the sold out show, thinking like, okay, maybe there will be people, other people a part of this. It won't just be my band and I just playing exactly. To empty rooms.
You know? You mentioned your band. Do you want to mention their names that were coming out with you?
Well, this show in Vegas, I'll be solo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wasn't sure about that. That's why I figured I'd ask.
So the band will be me and my right hand and my left hand.
And George and Ira Gershwin.
Yeah, let's go.
Be there. Yeah. In fact, you can guarantee a sold out performance if you say John with George and Ira Gershwin. I think
with Gershwin.
Yeah, I think that was done. Yeah.
We'll get some ticket sales from that.
Now, one of the hallmarks of your performances, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. I was wrong about the band, but I just assumed you were going to travel with a couple of people to back you up. But at any rate, you do have an impact emotionally on people that watch you perform. And you've told stories about people coming up to you. And I won't ask any specific stories, but what is that like when you get people coming up to you after a performance and they're telling you how much your music, your presentation, your songs, your lyrics mean to them?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the beginning, there's something uncomfortable about it that it took me a minute to kind of overcome that and not sell the moment short or cheapen the moment. Or, you know, now I feel like I'm fully able to participate in that and be present for it and not feel like, I think in the beginning I felt like, well, the move here is to be humble and downplay it. And now I realize that cheapens it, you know. It's just meaningful every time. And I think it's maybe because I've lived some life now and I can think of, in those moments, I think of the songs that have meant so much to me, you know, and the songs that, when I heard them, and this is a trait that I get from my grandfather and my dad has it, and now I have it. It's like when there is a beautiful piece of music, I remember my grandfather would tear up talking about some big band piece that he heard back in the 70s or something. And here it is, you know, 30 years later, and he's crying just thinking about this piece of music. So there are pieces of music like that for me that, like, when I heard them, I couldn't even talk about them for a couple weeks because they were so moving. And in those moments, you think, okay, so that's what this person is saying, that this song of mine was for them in some version of that it helped them through whatever time, or it was, you know, it was, if it was a song that they loved and their dad loved or their mom loved, and now their mom just passed away, and that was one of the things that they will always have that reminds them of their mother. You know, it's so beyond, I don't know. It's so cool. It's like, well, that's why music exists, you know, and I just get to be a part of it.
It was, in essence, their Rhapsody in Blue.
Yeah, right.
When they're reacting to you in a particular song.
Yeah.
And have you thought about your songs in the sense of your current album? I mentioned Scenario, different mm-hmm. way to say it. Have you thought about what particularly is it about your approach, other than obviously these songs are personalized, but what it is that hits people directly, whereas other performers, as you say, there's music, but not the lyrics may not mean anything. You just like the beat, or you just like the melody, mm-hmm. or it happens to be.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, and I have, this is maybe a left turn from your question, but I have gone back and forth on, when it comes to lyrics, explaining what lyrics mean or explain why I wrote this certain lyric, or like, what is that song about? Because I don't want to, again, cheapen that or put parameters on a particular song for someone by explaining it away and taking, you know, I want them to take whatever they take from it. And it's funny with this album Scenarios, you know, and all the streaming services, I can see obviously what each song is streaming every day, how many streams it gets, all that kind of stuff. And there's a song on there that if I have had 1,000 comments from fans about songs, 960 of them are about this one song called Acting on the new album. And it's interesting because it's not the number, it was not a single. I didn't put it out. I didn't even feature it. It's not one of the highest streamed songs, but there's something about that song that people immediately connect with. And in a way, I'm not surprised, because I'm like, this is an aspect of life, that the particular subject matter of this song, that I think every single human being, unless you live alone on an island someplace, you deal with this. This is like a fundamental part of being a social human being on planet Earth. And I'd never written about it. And I was really happy with how the song came out, and happy with that lyric. I think Ira would be, he'd be like, oh, I like that lyric. That's a good one. You know? So I don't know, but back here while I'm writing those songs, you can feel it. It's like, if it means something to me, it's probably going to connect with someone out there, you know?
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been singer-songwriter John McLaughlin. He's going to be bringing his Scenarios tour to Myron's at the Smith Center on April the 11th. For ticket information, go to thesmithcenter.com, thesmithcenter.com. And for everything about John, go to johnmcl.com, johnmcl.com. And you can follow him on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And John, thanks for being on the show.
I had a great time. Thank you for having me.
Here, absolutely. Thank you. See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. Hey, Las Vegas.